Good afternoon, or good morning, as the case may be. My name is Michael Cannon. I'm the Director of Health Policy Studies here at the Cato Institute. And we're here today because 25 years ago this month, on August 21st, 1996, President Bill Clinton signed into law legislation that created a special type of savings account. These savings accounts let Americans save money for their medical expenses tax-free, and the law called them Archer Medical Savings Accounts. Then 7 years later, in 2003, President George W. Bush signed a law that allowed even more Americans to save even more money for their medical expenses tax-free. That 2003 law, called the vehicle for that tax-free, those tax-free health savings accounts. So this month really marks the 25th anniversary of the federal government allowing Americans to save money tax-free for their medical expenses. That idea and the concept of tax-free savings has taken off since then. If you look at the number of health savings accounts that have been that Americans hold since 2011, they've grown almost fivefold, from 6 million health savings tax-free health savings accounts to 30.2 million. At the same time, the number or the amount that Americans have contributed to health savings accounts has grown pretty dramatically, from about $10 billion per year or $11 billion per year in 2011 to about $41 billion per year in 2020. And the amount of assets that taxpayers have accumulated in their health savings accounts that'll be available for them to spend on out-of-pocket medical expenses and so forth has grown even more dramatically to $127 billion, or I should say about $100 billion right now. And by 2023, projections suggest it will grow to nearly $130 billion. So health savings accounts have proven pretty popular. What we're going to be talking about right now is why the federal government created health savings accounts in the first place. And I'm very excited to have on this panel two of the nation's leading experts on health savings accounts, the tax treatment of health insurance, and the effects that the special tax treatment that the federal government has afforded to some forms of health insurance have had on health insurance and healthcare delivery and the quality of cost of healthcare. First, we've got John Goodman, who's the CEO and president of the Goodman Institute. John Goodman is also a scholar at the Independent Institute and has long been a proponent of health savings accounts and medical savings accounts. In fact, one of the first healthcare books that the Cato Institute published was Patient Power by John Goodman and Gerald Musgrave. And for his work promoting this idea, the Wall Street Journal has dubbed John Goodman the father of health savings accounts. Also on the panel, we've got Brian Blaze. Brian is the president of Blaze Strategies. He's a former economist with the National Economic Council in the White House. He is a former economist with the Senate leadership. In fact, he and I held the same position in the Senate leadership many years apart. And he's a former scholar at the Mercatus Institute. So welcome, John and Brian.
Glad to be with you.
John, I want to start with you. I want to ask, why did Congress create these vehicles for tax-free health savings in the first place? Why have something called medical savings accounts or health savings accounts that lets taxpayers save money for their health expenses tax-free?
Well, you know, it was amazing that they did it, because at the time, virtually every special interest group was on the other side, and they were either against the idea or they were neutral. And that includes the American Medical Association, the insurance companies, the Business Roundtable, the hospitals, just about every group you can think of was either against it or neutral. And that was also true in the think tank world. It was pretty much me and the Cato Institute and the think tank world. The other think tanks were not on board. It took them another 10 years before they came on board. So it was just a small group of people with a good idea. And it made so much sense that we got enough people in Congress to back it. And by the way, this was bipartisan. It's very important. Today, things have become extremely partisan. But in those days, we had Democrats and Republicans uniting behind this very good idea.
That's one of the reasons I like to point out that Bill Clinton signed the law of creating Archer Medical Savings Accounts, which are the 25 years ago, which were the precursor to health savings accounts. But Brian, maybe you can jump in here as well. Why have tax-free health savings? Why have tax-free savings for health as opposed to food or shelter?
Hey, thanks, Michael. And it is a real privilege to be on this panel with you and John. I've learned so much from both of you about health economics. You know, the tax code has incentivized third-party health insurance and a lot of control to employers. So with, you know, employers offering health insurance and with IRS decisions in the 1950s that made that a tax-free benefit, we've given a lot of control to employers over our health insurance and third-party health payment. I mean, what we increasingly, I think, know is that third-party payment has separated consumers from the providers of care and has led to lots of misallocations within within the healthcare sector. And when consumers have more control and power over the actual spending, they make better decisions. So we know that health savings accounts are associated with people making better decisions, spending less without any adverse health actions. So to, the tax advantage of HSAs is to create some amount of tax equity between third-party payment of health expenses with self, what John Goodman refers to as self-insurance, where the consumer controls the spending.
Sure, the tax code that's really been around maybe as long as the income tax has been, since 1913, where if your employer pays you a dollar in wages, that's going to be subject to the income tax. But if your employer takes that dollar and gives it to you in the form of health benefits, that's not going to be subject to the income tax. And then when 1935 rolled around and the Congress created the Social Security payroll tax, the health benefits were exempt from that tax as well. And as tax rates rose, Congress created the Medicare payroll tax and did other things to increase taxes. The difference between your employer giving you a dollar of cash wages that you go and spend on your health care and the same employer giving you that dollar in the form of health benefits that the employer controls and uses to make your health insurance and healthcare decisions, there's a big difference. Depending on your marginal tax rate, you can lose a substantial amount of money if you take that that compensation as cash wages. And so it creates this situation where either you let your employer control that dollar and buy your health insurance, or you're penalized in the form of a higher income and payroll tax liability. And so that creates a distortion that favors, I think, Brian, what you're saying is it creates a distortion that favors employer-sponsored insurance, that lets your employer control your health insurance decisions, that encourages people to buy more health insurance. And economists across the board have said that this is really a really stupid way to run a railroad. There's no logical reason why your employer should be making your healthcare decisions for you. There might be some pooling benefits. We could get into that later of employer-sponsored group plans. But there are definitely a lot of inefficiencies that are involved with letting your employer control that money and letting and the incentives that it creates when you can avoid taxes by buying more and more health insurance, more comprehensive health insurance. Economists generally tell us, most economists I think agree, that this thing that we call the tax exclusion for employer-sponsored insurance creates all sorts of problems in our healthcare sector, either creates or contributes to almost all of the problems that we see in our health sector. Excessive insurance, overutilization of care, excessive prices, and gaps in coverage because you lose employer-sponsored insurance when your connection to an employer disappears. There's one element before we get into specifically how health savings accounts try to solve these problems. There's one element of the exclusion that I think it's short shrift that I'd like to highlight, which is that when the tax code tells workers that either you let your employer control that dollar or you take it as income and pay taxes on it, That's a lot like a mandate and a penalty. Either you use your compensation in the way that we want you to, or you have to pay more money to the government. And so it creates a situation where, unless you let your employer control that money and choose your health insurance, you're paying higher taxes. And a lot of the people then end up letting their employer make that decision for them. And it's not just $1 we're talking about. For a family, for a worker with family coverage, it's about $15,000 on average of their earnings that they are letting their employer control, because if they don't, they'll have to pay taxes on it. And so over time, the exclusion has had this effect. If you look at this graph, what it shows is that since 2000, it shows the amount of money that employers control, or that the exclusion lets employers control, the amount of the workers' money the exclusion lets their employers control and use to pick their workers' health insurance, it has risen to about $1 trillion a year in 2019. It was about $1 trillion per year. Whereas, and if you, by comparison, the amount of money that workers are putting in health savings accounts had risen to only $39 billion per year. So that's less than 5% of the money that the exclusion allows employers to control, the amount of the workers' money that the exclusion allows employers to control. Health savings accounts have allowed workers to control a substantial portion of that without tax penalty, but there's still a lot of it that that workers don't control. Let's talk about how do health savings accounts work. So there are these tax-free savings accounts. John, can you tell us who can open a health savings account? What are the rules attended to health savings accounts? And are those rules working well? Are they causing problems also?
Well, you have to have catastrophic insurance in addition to your savings accounts. And unfortunately, the law requires an across-the-board deductible, which means this is a high deductible, several thousand dollars. And that means that you have to spend up to that deductible before you rely on your third-party insurance, regardless of what kind of care we're talking about. It could be insulin for a diabetic. It could be hospitalization. No distinction is made between the kinds of care that people ought to be in charge of and manage on their own and the kinds of care that are really difficult for patients to manage. So the law started out at a good place, but now it has trapped us in a situation where the health savings accounts works best if you're healthy and all you do is save. It doesn't work very well for the chronically ill. So one of the changes that Brian and I would like to see is to make these accounts conform to the chronic illness. So the diabetic, for example, could manage all his own dollars if he chose to do so. And if he's going to manage his own care, it makes sense for him to manage the dollars that pay for that care.
Yeah, so there's a perception that you just need a high deductible health plan in order to have that plan be HSA qualified. But like John said, there are other requirements on the insurance plan beyond that it has a minimum deductible. One of the main ones is that plan can't cover services below the deductible, except for sort of a limited set of preventive services. There's also out-of-pocket limit requirements. There's a requirement you're not allowed to have another health plan and have an HSA qualified plan. So there's products called sort of direct primary care plans, where you might contract with a primary care practice to provide your basic preventive primary care services. You can't have a plan like that and have make HSA contributions. So it's estimated that about 60% of people that have plans that have deductibles that meet the HSA requirements don't make HSA contributions.
So John has identified chronic care and how HSA qualified high deductible plans don't work very well for many patients with chronic conditions because you can't cover a lot of services below the deductible. Brian has mentioned direct primary care, which is what some people consider insurance. It's an arrangement with a physician practice where you pay a set amount per period, per month, per year. And then you get certain services because there's some pooling involved there. Brian, I think you're saying that the federal government doesn't allow you to have to make tax-free HSA contributions if you're enrolled in something else that it considers a second health plan, which is what it considers direct primary care. What all this says to me is that that we've got just as the tax code was creating perverse incentives when it comes to employer-sponsored insurance, this attempt to correct those perverse incentives through health savings accounts is also blocking, is also creating perverse incentives that prevent the healthcare industry from meeting the needs of consumers. With regard to the exclusion itself, the federal government was essentially penalizing consumers and insurance companies if they, if consumers bought insurance directly from insurance companies that avoided the problem inherent with employer-sponsored insurance, which is that if you change employers, you lose your coverage. Here, with health savings accounts, the federal government is still effectively penalizing health plans. It's allowing you to control a small portion of the money that your employer would otherwise control by putting that money in a health savings account without tax consequences, but it's still inhibiting the market from providing the sorts of health insurance plans that would make healthcare higher quality, more accessible, and more affordable for people with chronic conditions. So what do we do about this problem that even HSA, the supposed solution to the problems that the federal government had created with the exclusion, which is health savings accounts, what do we do to remove the barriers that HSAs are still putting in the way of the healthcare market and the health insurance market, innovating in ways that improve the cost and quality of care for patients?
Well, let's be clear about what direct primary care really is. We used to call it concierge care. And back when health savings accounts were originally created under the tax law, concierge care costs $10,000, $15,000 a year, and people could talk to their doctor by phone at nights and on weekends, and this was a luxury for the rich. But today, this model has really come alive, and now it's really inexpensive for an adult, middle age. It would be $50 a month for a child, $10 a month under a typical arrangement, and you get all primary care. And you have your doctor's cell phone number, and at nights and weekends, you can call the doctor instead of going to the emergency room. This is probably the fastest growing part of the market for health insurance right now. People like it. And of course, when COVID came along, this became even more important because people feared going to the emergency room because they're going to be around sick people and get COVID. So this is a very important kind of care for a very reasonable amount of money. You get all primary care. And the law does not allow the employer to put money into a health savings account and let the employee choose a primary care doctor. And that's really dumb. So one of the really important things to do is to liberate the employees and the employers and let them choose the kind of care that today with telemedicine is the most popular form of care in terms of growth in the marketplace.
And I want to ask you to talk about direct primary. Brian, before you jump in on direct primary care, I want to read a comment that we've gotten from Dr. John B. I'm not sure which social medium he used to post his question, but he writes, do you expect an exemption to the no first dollar for a direct primary care restriction, especially capitated DPC programs? He says that he has found, let me see if I get this straight, more than a 5-to-1 claim cost savings using direct primary care and their self-funded plans, but can't write them with HSA plans, which means that from their perspective, HSAs have negative value without the direct primary care option. So I wanted to offer you that because I figured you had more to say about direct primary care. And that's, an example of how HSAs might even be inhibiting direct primary care. And I also wanted to invite you to talk about what you did when you were at the White House to try to integrate direct primary care with HSAs.
You know, so your original question, you wrote a paper a decade ago large HSAs. It had three components of it in your reform. The first was to basically triple the amount of money that people could save in HSAs. The second was to allow people to pay premiums from their HSAs in order to create sort of tax parity between individually selected plans in the individual market with group coverage. The third was to delink HSAs from having a high deductible health plan requirement. I think that one is the most important one. And, you know, so I realize we are moving policy on the margin. So it is hard to do radical changes to the health sector overnight. There's a lot of political obstacles and a lot of inertia and special interests that protect the status quo. So my focus was, what can we do in the near term to expand HSAs, realizing that HSAs a way to get the power in the hands of the consumer. And when they have the power, then, I mean, what we really want is the supply side, the providers, to have to respond to consumer preferences. So what can we do to expand HSAs? I love the delinking HSAs from high deductible health plans. If we could pass legislation that does that, I think that's some of the most important legislation that Congress could enact. We had problems with the budgetary score of that. We looked at an alternative to dramatically expand what plans could be HSA qualified, and we came up with an actuarial value standard, and it was actually put in President Trump's 2020 budget, where any plan, regardless of how it was designed, that had an actuarial value. An actuarial value means that's the percentage on average of healthcare claims that the plan will pay. So any plan that has an actuarial value below 70% or 80% could be integrated with an HSA. And you would double or triple the number of people that have HSAs with that reform. Now, we couldn't do that administratively. What we looked at doing administratively were two things, one of which we accomplished and one of which we didn't. The first was to expand the preventive services that could be covered below the deductible. So we thought, all right, you are a diabetic, insulin is really important. A plan should be able to cover that below the deductible and still be able to be HSA qualified. Same thing, beta blockers or statins for people with heart conditions, inhalers for people with asthma. And in 2019, the administration expanded what could be considered preventive. So this was an IRS list. So you can now have a high deductible health plan that covers certain preventive services below the deductible like that and still be HSA qualified. So we were able to accomplish one thing that, you know, John Goodman has identified has a restriction on HSAs. The second is, could you integrate an HSA qualified plan with a direct primary care arrangement? And we pushed IRS on this hard, and it was not something we were able to accomplish. They were able in 2020 to issue a proposed rule that would allow people to use HSA or HRA amounts on a direct primary care arrangement, but they considered the direct primary care arrangement a separate plan. So you couldn't make HSA contributions if you had a direct primary care arrangement. Anyway, that is basically all for naught. That regulation was not finalized. But those are the ways we tried to expand HSAs, and with preventative care, we were able to expand what the type of plan people could have and still also make HSA contributions.
So I'm you know, glad you brought up
interject.
Go ahead, John.
Michael, if I could just interject a small bit of criticism for the Trump administration. I applaud everything Brian did. But, you know, politics governs everything. And we didn't have candidates out there, including President Trump himself, saying, look, this is what we want to do. We want you to be able to talk. We want Medicare patients to be able to talk to their doctors by phone and by email. We want you to be able to have an account where you can choose a primary care doctor that you can talk to at night and on weekends and get all your primary care for a very reasonable amount of money. So if all you're doing is dealing behind the scenes, it's really hard to get this done. I think a lot of the things that Brian's talking about would have had great political appeal if we had more candidates out there running on these issues, because I can tell you, these are the kinds of things voters really want.
Speaking of political appeal, John, you've mentioned, Brian, you mentioned more recently that there are all sorts of interest groups that try to block reform in this area, partly for ideological reasons, but also there are just interest groups that don't want to disrupt the massive cash flows from workers straight into the pockets of insurance companies and healthcare providers. We're talking about $1 trillion of workers' earnings every year that the worker never gets to touch. Their employer takes that money, sends it directly to insurance companies. If the worker tries to get that money back, they have to pay taxes on it, so the government penalizes them. And it's the people who are making money off of this system that are the biggest barriers to reform. There have been attempts from President George H.W. Bush on through President Obama and even President Trump tried, as Brian mentioned, to liberalize the rules around the tax treatment of employee health benefits so that workers could control more of that money or just to reform the tax exclusion generally. But it keeps running into this political buzzsaw of opposition that's both ideological and comes from special interest groups that are making money off of the current situation. So that's one of the reasons, actually, I mentioned that I put forward the idea that Brian mentioned of dramatically expanding health savings accounts, tripling the contribution limits so that people could take all $15,000 of that money that their employer controls and put that in a health savings account, and then they would get to decide how to spend it, and they would be able to pick plans that have that you can integrate with direct primary care or that provide first dollar coverage for chronic care below the deductible, and free from all of these rules that we're all talking about and that are frustrating patients and innovators right now. But there's a problem. How do you get it's hard to get any change, much less a big change like that. And so one of the things that I've tried to do is talk about what I displayed in that last graph that I showed, that the amount of money we're talking about here is really staggering. It is $1 trillion every year that the tax exclusion allows employers to control. $1 trillion of the workers' earnings that the tax exclusion allows employers to control. And if we reform if we talk about reforming the exclusion and expanding health savings accounts in a way that highlights to workers that that's your money and that you should get to control it, and with this change, you will be able to control it. Not only shouldn't that be attracted to workers, it would be, in effect, a tax cut that would be larger than any tax cut that President Trump or President Bush or even President Reagan had ever enacted. Imagine returning $1 trillion per year from the people who didn't earn that money to the people who did earn it. It's not a tax cut in the sense of getting that money out of the government's hands and giving it to workers. But it would be a change in tax policy that takes money that the tax code forces workers to forfeit, but instead allows them to keep that money. Wouldn't that have some appeal to, say, the party of limited government, the party of tax cuts, to be able to enact a reform that is that big, that sweeping, that would that it would be the largest tax cut in probably in American history, and also deliver better healthcare because it would allow people to control their healthcare dollars, choose healthcare plans that meet their needs, and that innovate in the direction of providing better access to care for people with chronic conditions and so forth. So the question is really about the politics of this, and wouldn't the idea of letting workers control all of that money, which is really theirs, have some political appeal?
All right, here's the political problem. You said $1 trillion, but the whole healthcare system is actually $3.5 trillion, and it's all connected. So we have a huge pot of money here. Now, if you're a senator or you're a member of Congress, what happens, even if you're Republican, is that every day somebody that's getting money from that $3.5 trillion is coming to your office. They're telling you what you want. So it's hard to imagine how it could be otherwise. There's so much money at stake. Now the Medicare woman who wants to talk to her doctor by phone, or the employee who wants to take his health insurance with him to the next job, they're not in there talking to that senator. And more than likely, the senator never hears about the problem. So the problems they hear about are special interest problems, and the special interests have no real incentive in radical reform of the system. Now, one of the things that happened on Brian's watch while he was there in the Trump administration was, and this is a radical change from the Obama administration, employers can now partially do what you said, Michael. They can put money into an account, and the employee can buy health insurance, which they own. And this came in effect a year ago, this last January, and a radical change from the Obama administration. Almost no coverage in the mainstream media, or even in the health care media. And I bet most employers don't even realize they can do this, but it's a step in the right direction. There are limitations. You have to buy Obamacare individual coverage. But if you stop to think about it, you have Blue Cross there. They sell group insurance and they sell individual insurance. One is tied to the employer. The other is portable. You can take with you. So the idea isn't that radical when you stop to think about it. But that was an important change the Trump administration made. And that I think of as a wedge into a very complicated, special interest dominated system.
It was a driving force behind a lot of the positive changes in healthcare we saw coming out of the Trump administration. Brian, do you want to talk about that one? Because what John is touching on are really not just one, but two different alternatives to health savings accounts, two different things that the federal government has done to allow workers to control some of the money that their employer controls. One of them, I think, dates back to the Carter administration, flexible spending accounts. But the one that John is talking about is health reimbursement arrangements, something that happened in the George W. Bush administration, but then because of your efforts, the Trump administration expanded on. Do you want to talk about that for a second?
I would love to. Thanks for setting me up, John and Michael. So in the summer of 2017, as Congress was getting bogged down in ACA repeal and replace, I called in the federal departments and I was like, okay, is the Republicans have campaigned on repealing and replacing Obamacare, providing relief, expanding options. It may be up to us. What can we do? I, of course, started with HSAs. HSAs are the best because the individual controls the account, carries it with them from year to carries it with them from employer to employer, amounts roll over. And as we already discussed, it was very hard to expand HSAs administratively. But the Treasury Department said, you know, the Obama administration did this thing on HRAs that we're not big fans of. And we're open to sort of going back and revisiting this. And what the Obama administration did is say it is illegal for employers to reimburse individual market premiums. And if employers do that, we will subject them to $100 per day per worker penalty. I mean, basically a nuclear bomb to prevent them from doing that. From our perspective, Republicans generally have been supportive of defined contribution health insurance arrangements. The books that I read on health policy decades often have started with, and Michael has laid this out, the number one problem with health policy emerges from the exclusion. For the reasons Michael mentioned, and what we can do is return choice and control to the worker, but through defined contribution arrangements. We spent about 2 years, starting in the summer of 2017, and we released a final regulation in the summer of 2019 that allows employers to contribute through health reimbursement arrangements for workers to buy coverage that works for them in the individual market. There's a variety of reasons this has to be, this is ACA compliant coverage in the individual market. But in essence, what we did was equalize the tax treatment between employer selected plans for all the workers and employer contributions that workers use to purchase coverage for them and for themselves and their families in the individual market. I mean, one of the problems, and this is kind of stunning, is 75% of firms with less than 200 workers that offer coverage only provide their workers one choice of plan. Think, what other financial product do individuals have so, major financial product, do individuals have so little control over? Even at large firms, a high percentage, I mean, it's almost half of large firms only offer their workers a single type of health insurance option. And we know from economic research that workers value choice of health insurance. So this is a way for employers, many of whom, particularly if they're small, don't want to be in the health insurance business, to offer a contribution that the worker takes to buy a plan that works best for them.
Okay, so we've got the tax exclusion. It says to workers, let your employers control $15,000 of your earnings, or else if you try to take that as cash, you'll pay taxes on it. So you may lose $3,000-$5,000 of it. So that's like a penalty. Around the time of the Carter administration, the federal government said, well, we'll let you control a small portion of that through something called a flexible spending account. You can put some of that, some money aside tax-free that you could spend on medical care, and you can determine how much that is, but if you don't spend it all by the end of the year, then you lose it. So that kind of creates, that doesn't really give you control over that money because you don't get to keep it. It creates a use it or lose it incentive. So that doesn't really solve the problem of the exclusion. The Archer medical savings accounts and then health savings accounts come online in the 90s and the early noughts. They let workers control a small portion of their health benefits dollars. Right now it's about $7,000 for a family, if you have family coverage, but only if you enroll in a very restrictive, as we talked about, type of health plan. And a lot of employers might not offer that. A lot of workers might not like that kind of health plan. And it only, HSAs have only given workers control over 5% of that $1 trillion. What, Brian, you're talking about with HRAs is something that happened in the Bush administration. And then John mentioned that the Obama, or I can't remember now if it was John or Brian, mentioned the Obama administration limited them. What health reimbursement arrangements do is they allow the employer to give the worker, basically, I call it a line of credit, where the employer will pay some of the worker's medical bills tax-free, again, without a penalty. So the worker gets to control that money. It doesn't go toward health insurance. And what the Obama administration said was, if the employer then takes that tax-free money, and I should also add, it's a line of credit because there doesn't have to be any sort of a funded account. There doesn't have to be any money at all. The employer doesn't have to fund it until the employee uses it. And it's a little like a flexible spending account, the health reimbursement arrangements are, because there's a use it or lose it incentive when you leave your employer. So you don't get to keep the money that you don't spend. So there's that perverse incentive as well. The Obama administration said was, if the employer tries to use this tax-free money to buy the worker individual market coverage, which would be a pretty significant step, giving workers more control over their earnings and more choice when it comes to their health insurance, the Obama administration said, we're going to penalize you. And then the Trump administration undid that. And now small employers, thanks to Brian's work and the work of others in the Trump administration, small employers can give their workers a portion of their earnings to use to spend on health insurance premiums without facing a tax penalty, that like they would if they tried to take that $15,000 from their employer and then go buy insurance as cash and go buy insurance themselves. But I'm going to return now to the point I made before, which is we've got health savings accounts, flexible spending accounts, and health reimbursement arrangements, all trying to take these small steps toward giving workers more control over that $1 trillion of their earnings, more flexibility in how to spend that money. And we're having a hard time doing it, or we're having a hard time getting these reforms passed both because of ideological objections and because the healthcare industry doesn't want workers to have the ability to say no to them. I'm going to pose a question to Brian now. John, you responded to this before. I want to get Brian's thoughts on the idea of reframing this entire debate over health savings accounts as a question of who gets to control that $1 trillion of the workers' earnings. If, and I think this has been a failing on our part, the part of advocates free market healthcare reforms, that we haven't frame this as an issue of it's the workers' money, they should get to control it, and geared our efforts on health savings accounts toward giving workers control over every penny of that $1 trillion. Wouldn't that help to overcome some of the political barriers that we run into in Congress, that you ran into in the Trump administration, Brian, where the only people that Congress is hearing from are the special interests? Wouldn't they also hear from taxpayers if we reframe the debate as providing that huge $1 trillion tax cut to workers?
Let me say one addition to your history, and then before I answer that question. So Congress also created something called QSERAs, Qualified Small Employee Health Reimbursement Arrangements, in the fall of 2016. So that's sort of a precursor to the individual coverage HRA. They did it in a bipartisan manner. It was signed into law by President Obama. It was more limited than what we did with the HRA rule, and it only applied to small employees. I think what we did with the HRA rule is bipartisan. It appeals to a lot of Republicans because they want defined contribution health insurance, more control in the hands of employees. And for Democrats, this is really a way to expand the number of people that have ACA compliant coverage and potentially double the size of the individual market. I think your political question, Michael, is really hard. I am deeply disappointed. I mean, in 2017, Republicans were going to do health reform out of the gate, and we did nothing legislatively to expand HSAs. We didn't do anything big to expand HSAs. We also didn't do anything small to expand HSAs. And I still don't understand what happened with the initial sort of legislation that came out of the House of Representatives. When we got to the Senate, the Senate started including HSA provisions. So they increased contribution limits. They allowed, I think, HSAs for premiums. They may have moved to the actuarial value standard. And I think right now, I think Republicans really dropped the ball when they had power in 2017 and 20. As far as framing this for individuals, it's complicated. People expect they're going to get insurance through their employer. And I don't know if they've been conditioned along the lines where they expect a group plan. And it's just sort of, we have to sort of fight inertia of individuals too. And individuals are afraid of changing the status quo. I mean, if you ask people what they think of the US healthcare system, a lot of people will say it's too costly, it's problematic. But then you ask people what they think of their own health insurance, and like 75% of people are happy with their own health insurance. Now, a lot of those people are people that hardly ever use their health insurance to get health care. But it does present a problem when you can have politicians create fear that whatever the change is going to happen is going to take away people's health insurance.
As David Goldhill likes to say, if you like your health insurance, it's probably because you don't know how much it costs. And I think that returning that $1 trillion to workers who earned it.
We've obscured the cost, so people don't know how much ago. I think, you know, these reforms that, you know, are defined contribution are in part to get people to understand exactly how much of their income they are losing in health insurance benefits. And I don't think a lot of people get that it's one for one. If your employer gives you a dollar of health insurance, it's because that dollar is coming out of your wages.
And that's, the tax code is keeping people ignorant in this regard. And the people who know that money is a one-for-one trade-off that they for every dollar of health benefits, they're not getting a dollar's worth of cash wages or other compensation. I think we haven't framed this properly. We haven't made that the cornerstone of our efforts to expand health savings accounts. And frankly, one of the reasons I think we need to do it is because something, Brian, you touched on. Republicans are terrible on this. They went into 2017 promising to repeal and replace Obamacare. The House bill didn't do any such thing. It didn't repeal Obamacare. Obamacare's central provisions would have remained. Same thing in the Senate bill. And as you say, they didn't do anything on health savings accounts. I think that maybe the only way to get Republicans to care about healthcare, to care about doing the right thing on healthcare and expanding health savings accounts, is if we frame it as a tax cut. And I think that's one of the arguments for pushing for wholesale reform of the exclusion, replacing the current exclusion for employer-paid premiums with a tax exclusion for HSA contributions, because that would deliver an effective tax cut of about $1 trillion per year. That's something Republicans can get their heads around. And it would also deliver us better healthcare. And unfortunately, you know, we get a lot of opposition because once consumers controlled that $1 trillion, not that much of they would stop sending all of that $1 trillion to the health sector year after year. And there would be a lot of wailing and grinding and gnashing of teeth among healthcare providers because all of a sudden consumers would have more say in their healthcare spending. And a lot of inefficient providers would have to. Would probably go out of business as a result. So we are running low on time. We're coming almost to the end. I want to ask both John and Brian, what's your agenda for health savings accounts right now, or reforming the tax treatment of health insurance more broadly? What changes should Congress be making this year? What reforms should candidates for federal office be putting into their platforms? John.
Well, here's something I think that is very doable. You mentioned three kinds of savings accounts that we have, and probably they cover more than 100 million people combined. And each of these accounts has advantages over the other two, and each of them has disadvantages over the other two. And the advantages are things that people like, and the disadvantages are things that people don't like. So I would like to see a reform where we give everybody access to a single account. And this account should be flexible, should fit with any third-party insurance. It should be individually owned and travel with the individual from job to job. And it should roll over from year to year. And I think that would be have a lot of voter appeal. We get rid of a lot of regulations that don't make any sense. And I don't see why we couldn't do something like that in a bipartisan way.
Brian? Brian, I'm not hearing you. I don't know if others are.
Sorry. The question was about the tax treatment of health insurance, I think the most important thing that Congress can do this year is defeat the expansion of ACA subsidies. They are very distortionary, inflationary, and just create a host of problems. So that is, to me, the top tax health policy issue. It's probably not going to be bipartisan. As far as HSA policy, I think the most important thing is to expand. I like John's idea. I think that you have all these accounts and it makes sense to sort of get all the stuff that we like about them and have one simple account that people understand and that is carried with people over time, like HSAs are, HRAs are useful in that now you can use them to pay for individual market premiums, but that's only if the employer decides to do that. It's the employer sets the contributions for sets the rules for the account. I think we need to expand the number of people that have HSAs. So anything that increases the plans that can be integrated with health savings accounts is, I think, the most important type of reform.
And you mentioned that the 70% actuarial value standard that you proposed in the Trump administration would expand the number of HSA holders by how much?
It would double them. So it would double them with not that significant of a budgetary cost. If you went to an 80% actuarial value standard, our modeling, and the modeling was done by the Treasury Department, we triple the number of households that have HSAs.
So of those three changes that you mentioned.
Let's be clear about what Brian's talking about. He's really talking about getting rid of a lot of regulations that interfere with giving people what they want. And then if you maximize individual choice and you maximize what the market can deliver, of course more people are going to have health savings accounts. So it's a great idea.
So you expand the universe of health insurance plans that people can have, that people can tie to a health savings account, and that entitles them to make tax-free HSA contributions. And I'm all for that idea. I think one of the you mentioned in the Brian, in the three parts of the large HSA proposal that I put out 10 years or so ago, one of them was to triple the contribution limits. Another one was to eliminate the requirement that you have health insurance in order to have a health savings account. And the third is to allow people to purchase health insurance tax-free with their HSA funds. I think you may be right. It may be that first the prong that expands the universe of health plans that you can accompany or that can accompany a health savings account. My preference would be to get rid of that requirement entirely, because anytime the government creates a tax preference for people who buy health insurance, the government's got to define what health insurance is. And inherently, that's going to limit the market. It's going to limit people's ability to get the type of health insurance that they want, the ability of innovators to introduce new products and gain a toehold in the market, because they're not going to be eligible for those tax preferences. I like John's idea of combining all of those all tax advantaged savings accounts or spending arrangements into one account that has the advantages of all and the disadvantages of none. I think that the large health savings account proposal, tripling the contribution limits, eliminating the insurance requirement, and allowing tax-free purchases of health insurance, I think it accomplishes all of those things. And it also allows us to talk about health savings accounts in a totally different way, or in an additional way that appeals to people who usually don't listen when it comes to healthcare. And by that I mean Republicans and conservatives, so that we can help to and talk about it in a way that can help to overcome the political resistance to genuine reform that we're always going to see from the healthcare industry. So we are awfully close to our quitting time at 1 p.m. I want to thank Brian Blaze of Blaze Strategies, John Goodman of the Goodman Institute, and the Independent Institute for joining us today. I want to encourage all of our viewers to follow at Cato Health on Twitter and subscribe to the Cato Health newsletter for more updates about events and publications that the Cato Institute is putting out on health policy. And we hope to see you at our next Cato Health event. Thank you.